You're listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Auto D Show here on Dave Pratt's Star Worldwide Networks, broadcasting from high above Camelback Road in beautiful Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Daniolo, and tonight I will be joined once again by the one and only Glenn Crimson, as he brings in an old friend who has really made his mark in this town and beyond, Brad Buxer, formerly with the Jetsons, and then, of course, in varying capacities with Matthew Wilder, Steve Wonder, and Michael Jackson, just to name a few. We'll be joining Glenn and I right after I play an old song of mine called She's So from an EP I released entitled All Right Already. So check it out here on the Auto D Show. She's so. And that was She's So by yours truly here on the Auto D Show, which is brought to you in part by my good friends at Fervor Records and also by TheRecordingArtist.com, where every Wednesday evening I record bands live online while you watch. To learn more, visit TheRecordingArtist.com and be sure to watch my companion TV show on Amazon Prime called The Recording Artist. It's kind of cool. Now, let's bring on my co-host for tonight's show, Mr. Glenn Crimson. Glenn, how are you doing?
That was a pretty good song.
Oh, did you listen to that?
Yeah. Was that really you?
Yeah, it was really me.
Okay. All right.
One of those crazy things you do in one late night in the studio.
Not bad.
You know? But let's mention your background. Your background, you come out of a band called The Box of Cherries. We talked about The Box of Cherries last time.
Yeah. Well, in the era when I knew Brad, when we used to hang out and pack the clubs, especially his band.
What was his band?
I was in The Spiffs and The Urge. But Brad, before we get on to the Jetsons, I first met Brad, from what I remember, he was in a band called Sky Harbor playing at the Mason Jar 2, and I did sound for you guys, and from what I remember, you didn't like what I was doing sound-wise or something.
Well, before you say you guys, let's bring him on the show. So welcome to the show, Mr. Brad Buxton.
Hi, nice to be here, thanks.
And I left all dejected. And
Glenn, we didn't know each other back then. I never once felt anything about the sound. I remember nothing about that.
Oh, so. I thought I read where you just ripped him in the paper. About
no.
The
And oh, the no. Okay. thing is that it was such a weird misunderstanding because we should have been friends way back then, right?
Yeah.
And for some reason with band rivalries or this or that or because people think they're cool or
teenage
whatever.
Teenage egos.
Band rivalries. And,
yeah.
Especially my ego, for sure.
It was just, life is thin, right? So it's like you have misunderstandings and we never ever rubbed each other wrong or anything, but we never connected back then. And then years later, after all this time, we realized how much we enjoy each other. So
that's cool.
He's a great talent.
He is a great guy. But I just wanted to first just thank you for coming down and being on the show. I appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.
You ready for the holidays?
Yeah, I'm not doing anything.
That makes it nice. Just taking a break.
No, I go back to Nashville tomorrow and get ready for work.
So, okay, cool. Yeah. Very, very cool. All right, well, listen, Glenn, you have a past in this market with these bands when the Jetsons were really big and when you guys Urge and everybody was playing. So why don't we let you dive in and take Brad through the ringer here, through the old days.
Well, I just found out through Stuart Galladay, a good friend of mine, we were in a couple bands together, and his brother was in your band, the Jetsons. But he said you were in a band right after high school with Bruce.
Yeah.
Bruce Canole and Stewart.
Yeah. So we were doing, original music, and our lead singer, Larry Willis, said, check out this guitar player. So Bruce came over. I was 16. Bruce was 19, had long hair, and Bruce is a brilliant player. And so we heard him play, and we started working with him.
I always say he was the best songwriter in town ever.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
And it pisses me off because that includes me. So.
Bruce is an amazing talent.
Yeah.
So okay. Do you remember the name of that band?
And a fucking amazing guitar player.
Yeah.
One of the best guitar players ever.
Yeah.
And sings his ass off.
Yeah.
A huge talent.
So then from there, though, he was in Billy Clone and the Same and you weren't. So how did that happen?
I mean, I was in college, right? So I'm doing this like academic thing, and Billy Clone and the Same was tearing it up in Phoenix, right? And senior year of college, 1980, I think, I'm sitting watching a concert because you have to get credit for watching concerts. And a girl next to me says, Mike Court just died.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, okay. And after that, Bruce and I started working together. It was kind of like almost made to.
Yeah.
Kind of just, when she told me that Mike Court died, immediately I knew I was going to be doing something with Bruce.
Really?
Not even sure why, yeah.
Destiny somehow?
Yeah.
Well, I went to Mike Court's funeral, man. I was the biggest Billy Clone fan on earth, man.
So was I.
Used to pogo, jump up and down to the punk and everything at the
like
Solid Gold.
She's so remember? Primitive. And
oh, my God. Come on, song. Asexual.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Ah!
Great stuff.
She's so primitive.
Yeah.
So good. Yeah, okay. So then then you got the Jetsons together right after that?
Yeah, what happened is Bruce was doing the Burning Flamingos. So after Billy Clone went down, he fired up Burning Flamingos, which did not work, right? And they got rid of, it was Damon's brother, Don Doran?
Yeah, Don Doran?
Yeah, replaced him with me. And then we sort of struck a nerve in Phoenix. And
Were still called the Flamingos then, or did you change the name?
No, the Jetsons.
Oh.
Bruce, when we were talking about this. Bruce approached me about, coming into the band. And it was almost like the next day or that same day, he said, what do you think about the name the Jetsons? And honestly, I didn't even think about it. I just thought, if that's what he thinks, fine.
Uh-huh.
It didn't strike me as a great name or not a great name or anything, but it was Bruce.
Right.
I said, fine. Good. It was fine.
How quick was it that the Jetsons kind of became a thing, like right out of the gate?
Real quick. Sick. Yeah.
And, you know, part of the animosity, I guess, from my point back then, Steve Gallaudet, which was your drummer,
right,
was in the Spiffs, and he quit the Spiffs to join Bruce and you.
Right.
And I go, what? I mean, because the Spiffs were very popular at that time.
Right. Uh-huh.
And he just took a chance. I guess he went to high school with Bruce maybe or something, or school.
Yeah,
or
East High or something. Yeah. Yeah.
And so he just quits my band flat to join you guys. What? You know. But it worked out for him because you guys ended up to be the biggest band, local band ever in Phoenix that didn't get a record deal. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, we know why, right?
Okay, well, I don't know why.
For you to go national, you have to have everything working on all eight cylinders, right? And we didn't have that.
Okay.
And without going into details, it's like, you know, you have different, you have the management is part of it, and the way the band operates is part of it, and, you know, the lifestyles is part of it. And so without going into any of this, the band clicked musically on a fucking amazing level. It's like we had the fire department clearing out the clubs we were playing every fucking night. So, and Bruce was the star.
Right.
You know, me and Damon surrounded Bruce, and Steve was in back, right? And it just, it was magical. And that doesn't mean you're always going to make it nationally. You know, a lot of other things have to come into play. And with us, you know, we had our imperfections. And I don't want to go into those imperfections, but you know, it didn't go national.
Right.
Yeah. And so, whatever.
So, did you guys, like, recruit Steve from the Spiffs? Or
I have no fucking idea. I know that
he was such a great drummer,
man.
I know that when I took over for Don, the rhythm guitar player at Burning Flamingos, and we became the Jetsons, Steve was there, Damon was there, I was there, and Bruce was there. That's all I know.
How many years were the Jetsons on the scene?
3 years. We started, the first gig was New Year's 1981. The last gig was June 12th, 1983 at Dooley's. The biggest gig we ever fucking did.
You guys would play
in
Devil House?
Bruce tore this shit up. They built a ramp for him, right? And Bruce was in his altered state, which is probably the best state for Bruce. And was eating the guitar strings with his teeth and performing like a star like you've never seen.
Right.
He was mobbed. He went to the bathroom and he was fucking mobbed. It was like there was 3,000 people there, and it was crazy. It was the biggest gig we ever did. And we had fired our manager 4 weeks before that, and so that's why the band broke up, because Damon went with the manager, and there were some conflicts of life's complicated, right? But Bruce is an amazing performer.
Well, at the very end there, when Damon left, I guess, like you just said, I know I auditioned for you guys because you and Steve wanted me in the band.
Everyone. We auditioned every fucking person in Phoenix, every person that we could find in L.A., and we could not replace Damon.
Yeah, he's so sick good. He doesn't want to play anymore.
We still see him. Like, you were, I think you were George's when Damon was over, I'm not sure. But we see Damon. You know, Damon's great.
When I did that Mason Jar reunion 10 years ago, he didn't want to play, but he agreed to come up, and we did a celebration. We held a picture of Steve Gallaudet up, him and I, and had a moment of silence for him and stuff.
Yeah.
It was really touching.
We miss Steve. Love Steve.
Yeah, man. He was my best friend of all time.
I know he was, yeah.
So
when you were back then, were you writing with the Jetsons, or were you just playing?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote, the biggest song we had was You, and I co-wrote that with Bruce, and I co-wrote 431, and wrote all the hooks to Hard Times, and we did co-writing together.
Angel?
Yeah. Well, Angel, I don't think so.
Oh.
Yeah.
All great songs.
Yeah.
I love you. I love you. That's great. I mean, that's
how much of the Jetsons catalog is available out there? I mean, is it on Spotify?
Fervor owns it.
Okay.
Right? And those guys are great. And Jeff and David. And they own it.
Yeah.
So Fervor owns everything in Phoenix.
Yeah, they own the Spiffs and Box of Cherries now too.
They're a great operation.
And Gentlemen After Dark, you remember them? And they own them, and they just had a big song in Stranger Things.
Yeah.
So
They put our music in
tons of stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, I have this for you from Franco's interview we did here. Here's a Mason Jar matchbook for you.
Awesome. Yeah.
There you go. You, you can have it.
I bet you used to have some of those.
So, you know what I really remember about the Jetsons, other than if you're not in line at the Mason Jar, like Friday night, there's a line. I mean, 100 people before the doors even opened. It was sickness.
Yeah.
But what I remember, the scene, it was always so packed when you guys played at Merlin's and even Devil House, 2,000 people. You drew at Devil House on a fucking Sunday night.
Yeah.
Fuck you guys.
The Devil House, the sound sucked. You know? It was always washed out. But Merlin's, with that low ceiling, and Mason Jar had that big pole in the middle, which sucked, right?
Yeah.
But Merlin's, which used to be the Star System, was the bomb.
Stars.
And that's, and we'd have cars lined up through the whole parking lot, half a mile back.
It was sickness.
Yeah, it was unbelievable, yeah.
And but I, what I remember is the people used to smoke clove cigarettes then. That was the thing or something. And so, swear to God, about 3 years ago, I bought a pack of clove cigarettes, and I had a whiskey at my house with a clove, and my girlfriend goes, "You don't smoke. What are you doing with it?" I go, "It's reminding me of the Jetsons era at the Mason Jar, man."
Right.
And that's why I smoke them, just to put me in that era, because it
that,
was
that
so
was
cool.
It was a great time.
Oh,
great time,
my God,
in Tempe,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy. So what year was the last of those 3 years? You mentioned it was 3 years
ago. Yeah,
long.
It was 1983, June 12th was the last gig we did.
Oh, wow, you remember the exact
thing? Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And I remember after the gig talking to Damon, and Damon was actually considering staying on, but he had such a tight bond with Laird, our manager,
mm-hmm.
that he wasn't going to stay on.
Right.
And so he left. For about 6 months, Bruce and I tried to replace Damon, couldn't do it. And then on November 8th, I was the last person that was around. So in other words, Damon left, and then Steve left, and then finally...
Well, Craig Romero played for you guys for a while.
Yeah, Craig's a good drummer.
That's another fucking drummer of mine you guys took. He was with me in the Urge, remember?
So here's the thing. We're at the band house in Tempe, and Bruce even left, right?
Right.
And Bruce knocks on my door, and he said, "Can I have your shoes?" Right? And so I gave him my shoes, and next thing, he's on a plane. So at any rate, I'm like, okay, I'm the last person standing, so I go to L.A., and have no idea what I'm going to do. I knew one manager, Al Benetta, who had been interested in the Jetsons. So the first day did nothing out there. The second day knocked on his door. And he had an artist named Matthew Wilder. And he let me stay there. And I had my equipment with me. And I started doing Matthew's album.
That's pretty cool.
And the Break My Stride kept going up each week. And so it was 47 when I first got out there, you know, and I'm knocking on Al's door. Each week it went up, and if several weeks later it was number 5 on the pop charts, and in LA it was number 2, right? So now we're having to put together a band. So Al, who was interested in the Jetsons, knew what I could do, and Al had me put together the band. So I put together a band for Matthew, hired musicians in LA, and recreated the album. And then we did a bunch of TV shows that year in 1984.
Wow. And I mean, you just kind of walked right in the right time.
Yeah.
With the right talent set.
You were on that video, right? Break My Stride.
Yeah, yeah. So we did Solid Gold. These shows are going to be old for a lot of people.
Remember.
But there was Solid Gold. We did American Bandstand twice.
Wow.
We did Soul Train, stuff like that. 9 TV shows that year of 1984. And that's when I met Gary Elazabal, who was Stevie Wonder's engineer. And I actually met him through Bruce Knoll and through Sion Chafin, who's a movie producer, married to David Fincher. And so hit it off with Gary, and then Stevie liked the way I played, and Stevie put me in his band. So it just kind of, like a lot of things just happened.
You know, you have to have enough talent, and you also have to have that hang ability. Because sometimes if you could be a good player, but after they meet you, they're kind of like, "I don't want this guy."
Yeah, you got to have a bunch of sensibility.
Yeah.
So the way it worked is, first of all, you got to be humble and be willing to do a bunch of grunt work, right?
Yeah.
So Gary Elazabal said, "Will you play on my girlfriend's stuff, Nina Tolbert's, for free?" So I said, "Sure."
Of course.
So I go to Wonderland, 729 Southwestern in East LA. It sucks. It's a terrible part of town, but that's where Wonderland Studios is, if I got the address right. And I go there, and they liked what I did on Nina's stuff. I kept getting called back, and then one day, Stevie's in there, and Stevie says, "Who's that playing?" And Gary says, "That's Brad, the guy I've been telling you about." And then all of a sudden, I started working on In Square Circle, and then that went really well. And then one night I got called 2:30 in the morning because Stevie works at night in the opposite hours. And went to Wonderland and we talked. And next thing I know, I'm in Stevie's band, which is called Wonderlove.
How intimidating was that?
I love Steve. It was not. It was like.
So when it happened, you just were comfortable making the jump, no problem.
Yeah. I mean, and it was funny because we finished in Square Circle, and that meeting at 2:30 in the morning took place just before the tour, right? And so now we're rehearsing in Coliseums, like in Oregon and Seattle. I forget what the stadiums were, and we had 3 days to get the show together, right? Well, Wonderlove has been playing together forever, so they already have all their stuff together, but I'm new and I have to learn all the parts real quick. So, you know, Nate Watts, who's, I talked to him yesterday, he's Stevie's musical director, we're great friends, one of my best friends, you know, they were showing me the parts and I'm trying to pick it up, and we're actually on stage in the middle of a Coliseum, whereas Michael, you're in a stadium at one end of it. With Stevie, you're in the middle of a Coliseum. So we're on stage, there's no one around, and we're rehearsing, and they're showing me the parts, and I'm trying to learn them, and everything worked out. And 3 days later, we're doing our first show. So it's pretty cool.
Even in the Jetsons era, you always had, like, the newest, you know, gear that
we had the very
out.
First OBXA. So
how did that happen? I mean, that must have cost a fortune.
Here's the thing. Laird Davis, right, who had a huge misunderstanding with me, and he thought I hated him, and that's a tragedy, because if that had not been the case, the Jetsons would probably still be around. But Laird was so convinced that I wanted him fired that a lot of problems happened within the Jetsons. But the point is, Laird was the reason I was able to get the very first Oberheim OBXA, because he put that together in a deal in LA. So
cool.
I drive out to LA, and for $4,300, I never forget numbers, there's the OBXA. And Guitar Center, wherever we were buying it from, was not even willing to let me have it because it was the only one.
Yeah.
And I'm on the phone with Laird, and we're talking back and forth, and finally they let it go, and I drive back to LA. So we had the very first OBXA. I think there was an OBX before that, but the OBXA had the eight voice, you know, dual layer.
I remember when keyboards were coming out back then. Every time there was a new one out, it was like that brand new car was coming out or something. It was a big deal.
So there was the OBXA and the Prophet, right? Yeah. The DX7 was thin. It sounded thin. But the two synths that I used were the OBXA and the Prophet, and then I think I had a mini Moog and then a smaller Moog too.
Cool. The learning curve on all the sequencing, on all that shit, how did you...
It was
fucking
easy.
Genius, man.
No. Now it's complicated, where you bring in the younger guys to show you how to get through the internet to get the latest plugs and how to keep your system stable. Back then it was easy. Yeah. You know, so the way we sunk up things is like there was a guy named J.L. Cooper in L.A. And he was the only guy who knew how to sync. This is sort of technical. 24 pulse per quarter, which is MIDI clock, to get the sequencers to sync with the drum machines. And we were one of the first people to do that. And so on my OBXA, he put mods in, so on You, the song You, which has that sample and hold thing, we're actually able to sync up the sample and hold to the MIDI clock coming from the CR-8000 drum machine. So
what the fuck, you lost me already, and you it's like second nature to you, though. Even back then when you first got that shit,
it's easy stuff. So we were always into the sort of technical part of it.
Yeah
That's cool. Back then, that technical part was simple.
Yeah, now and you know what's funny is you go back to the DX7 you mentioned, right? The first DX7, on the face of it, it was just a big metal panel because there weren't a lot of buttons. But they drew the diagrams of the algorithm. They were so proud of the electronics. No one had ever seen a digital synth like this.
Right.
So they actually drew the guts on the outside.
It was the first synthesizer where the harpsichord actually sounded like a harpsichord, right?
Yeah.
Everything else had been muddy and soft. Right. And this thing was sharp and digital and stuff like that. And then after that, the M1 came out and the D50 came out and stuff like that. But
remember all this. Since,
you know, we're talking about you leaving Phoenix and going on to greater and better things. I was thinking today of other Mason Jar players, because that's really my heart and soul, the Mason Jar era, right? So I was thinking of other players that went on to do some national things, which is so cool. So you remember Kevin Pate, you know? He went to New York and did some stuff with Brian Setzer, right?
Right.
Winston Watson. He played with Bob Dylan for whatever, yeah, 10 years or that. Something.
Yeah.
Gentlemen After Dark, they got produced by Alice Cooper,
right,
for Christ's sake. You know, Schoolboys went on to get record deals straight from the mason jar, and they're working with Eddie Kramer the next fucking day, you know, getting him produced. And I got to play with Bob Welch. I mean, so many of us just got out of that jar and did really cool shit. But you just fucking pissed on us, man. You're over there, Michael Jackson. Fuck me.
Somebody has to go to the top. We've all done interesting things. Everyone's done some really good things. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like you say, you're in the right place. Going to LA the next day, knocking on a guy's door and saying, great, work with this kid who has a record. It's on the charts. It's probably not going to do anything. It's number five.
I'll give you the whole list.
That's killing it.
Chronologically, of how simple this is and how normal this is.
Yeah.
So I knew one manager in L.A. There's Jetsons is no longer, and because the manager had seen me play, has me do the one artist he has, Matthew Wilder, who has one minor hit. Yeah. You know, it's very thin. Put together a band because now the hit's getting bigger and we have to play TV shows. From there, I meet Stevie Wonder's engineer. From there, I play on his girlfriend's stuff for free. From there, Stevie hears me, puts me in his band, and I tour with Stevie for 6 years. And
imagine who's going to hear you.
And
now
had a great relationship with Stevie.
Yeah.
You know, the key to everything is having a huge relationship with the main guy.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that. It just happened. We had the best time together. And so what does that actually mean? It means when we're in Australia, Stevie and I are close enough where I can run up behind him, grab him by the neck, wrestle him to the ground, and start punching him. That's a relationship. That's what I would do with George, right? My mm-hmm. best friend. So the thing is, that's the relationship I had with Stevie. And the players, when I first got in Stevie Wonder's band, they didn't know me. You know, no one knew if this was going to work, but it did work. And so you begin to have tremendous relationships with those players. So from Stevie's situation, after the third year of touring with him, we're touring about 6 months a year. Now I'm doing Smokey Robinson and the Temptations and the Four Tops and all the Motown people. So now I get a call from Michael's people in 89 and start doing a session for Michael. And immediately we hit it off. So I walk into Westlake and Billy Bottrell called me in and I look through the double glass and there's fucking Michael, right? And I've never been starstruck by anybody. I think it's really dumb.
Yeah, I get it.
I think it's just bullshit. You know, everyone's ego and but I was like totally starstruck because that there's nobody bigger on the planet. Walked in, there's a red Lin drum machine, no scratches on it, and there's an Emulator 3, and I start programming some drums and doing stuff, and Michael sitting across the control room, and there's only me, Billy Bottrell, I think Matt Forger, the assistant engineer, and me. So me, Michael, Billy Bottrell, and Matt. And I'd be doing drum machine programming. Michael's looking at me. If I make a mistake, he'd laugh. We just hit it off immediately. I mean, immediately.
Yeah.
And so I got called back again and again to do sessions. And that led to me doing the entire Dangerous album. And then at the end of the Dangerous album, I knocked on, I don't want to say the wrong thing, because I was incredibly loyal to Steve, but Stevie had stopped touring, right? We toured from 86 through 91, but that was the last year that Stevie did full tours. You know, he still does one-offs, and he's huge.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, one of the greatest talents of all time.
Sure.
But I knocked on Michael's door. He had an office at Record One. And so I said, I don't know if I should say some of this stuff. At any rate, I ended up in Michael's band, right? I'll just leave it at that, right? So I got a call from Benny Collins after the Dangerous album was done, just a few months. And he goes, rehearsals start when? And I go, shit, seriously? So I go to rehearsals. And like, you know, it's Ricky fucking Lawson, Donnie Boyan on bass, David Williams on guitar, Jennifer Batten. You know, huge players. And so, and it was funny because the first rehearsal, Donnie Boyette's sitting on the drums and Ricky's playing bass and they fucking sounded great. And Ricky's the drummer and Donnie's the bass player. So it's like, I'm just sort of watching all this. But At any rate, Brian Loren was the other keyboard player, and he was the musical director for that. And Brian Loren had done some really good work on Dangerous. So at any rate, me and Brian are the keyboardists. Brian's the boss. I'm the other keyboard player. Donny Boy is the bass player. Jennifer Batten's the lead player. Ricky Lawson's the drummer. And David Williams, the guitar player, the rhythm player. So at any rate, we rehearsed. And when you do a rehearsal like this, you'll rehearse for 3 weeks just by yourselves, 2 weeks more with the singers, and then join production for 4 weeks. That's how it works.
Wow.
So
wouldn't that be fun to prep that much for a show?
No.
Yeah. So we do that and do the Dangerous Tour. And now it's time to do the Super Bowl 27. And for whatever reason, Michael had me do the music. So the way it worked is before we started the Dangerous Tour, 2 days before, Brian Loren left the band and Greg Fillinganes came in, right? Because Michael wasn't happy with that part of the band. So,
interesting.
Yeah. So now
Greg's great.
Greg's the best.
Yeah.
Greg's the best
in
the world.
I got to work with him on one little thing.
Yeah, he is the best in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. No one can touch him. So Greg Fillinganes is now the musical director, and I'm the other keyboard player, just like before. We do the first half of the Dangerous Tour, and now it's time to do the Super Bowl. For whatever reason, I do all the music for the Super Bowl. Michael likes it, and whatever happens, Greg left. Greg was not fired. Greg decided to leave. You know, you can't. How do you fire Greg Fillinganes? It's impossible, right?
Yeah.
He left on his own. So now, what happens? Well, Michael makes me the musical director because they're happy with the Super Bowl stuff. And I need another keyboard player, so I bring in Isaiah Sanders from Stevie's band, right? And all the Stevie licks work with the Michael songs. That simple. If you're a keyboard player, Stevie licks work with Michael's music. That's how it works.
Cool.
That's how synergistic it is. So Isaiah was perfect for it. I was the musical director now. There was Isaiah and the rest of the players I mentioned. And so now we do the second leg of the Dangerous Tour, and that's done. And in 1993, Michael and I write Stranger in Moscow, which I didn't get writing credit, but it's on Wikipedia. It even says Brad Buxer and Michael Jackson wrote it, and Brad's on credit. So at any rate, the industry knows about it. So at any rate,
it's not uncommon.
We come back, and I was always with Michael even when we weren't touring. So I was always in the studio with him. So that meant a lot of times just being up at the ranch. So we're up at the ranch, and I start playing Stranger in Moscow again, and he lights up, and he sends me off to New York. And so I go off to New York. I bring Eddie Delaney, who's an engineer, really good engineer, and Matt Forger, assistant engineer. Go to Sony Studios, and for a month, I'm just putting together Stranger in Moscow. So I do all the drums. I do all the percussion from a beatbox he did, which I used samples on the E3 for. Just cut up his beatbox and sampled
cool.
it and sequenced it. And at any rate, he comes out to New York after I've been there for a month and listens to it and is shrieking and freaking out. He loves it so much. And so that's when the History Project started.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so now we're doing history. And so your question was, how did all this work? And I just gave you the timeline for everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? Like you say, it's life's thin. It's you've
very
experienced
thin.
that a step ahead or a step behind, and that piece of the story never connects. Neither do any of the pieces after.
You got to be able to wear a bunch of different hats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I remember exactly where I was when you were on the Super Bowl and me jumping up in the living room going, that's fucking Brad Buxer up there. That's him right there.
That was so funny because Ricky Lawson, the drummer who's no longer alive, a brilliant drummer, forgot to bring his drumsticks.
You're kidding.
And was freaking out.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, was freaking out. And so we're about to do the performance. He has nothing to play. You know, so the cameras never, you know, he just kind of did his thing, yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So I remember about that era, it was 94, 95-ish or something. I was in L.A., and I called you somehow, and you said, come on over. So I went to your house, and before cell phones and stuff.
That was a house on the hill, right?
Yes, yeah. House on the hill.
Right.
And you said, well, here, you want to hear Michael Jackson's voice or whatever, and you play a message that he left you, and he said, oh, Brad, I have this idea, blah, 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 yeah. blah, blah, blah. And then you said to me, so that's how the songs are written. He leaves me a message like that or something, and then I turn that into a song,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, when I did the seminars, we do them in different parts of the world. We did Paris in April, and we did Germany in July. And when I say we, I do it with my partner, Michael Prince, who partner's the wrong word. He's a great engineer, and he's in L.A., and he brings the files out and stuff like that. But
is that the same thing you did at the Music Conservatory when I saw you?
It's a little different because you have a paying audience and they buy tickets and stuff like that. But we play phone calls where Michael's saying, now, Brad, I want this, I want that, and I want that. Yeah. And then I have to turn that into, yeah.
And then I also, from that same day, I remember and I thought, this fucker is just rubbing this in my face, man. So
no,
I know, but this is what happened. This is what happened, right? So we go from the house and from that house on the hill, and you say, "Hey, I just bought a house in Hollywood Hills or something, and you want to go see it?" So we're riding to go see it, and then we stop at the bank, and you went in and got like a $400,000 cashier's check or something like that.
What was
I'm
it for?
At the window. It was for the house down payment or some payment on the house, and then I'm just thinking, what the fuck is going on here? It was great, man.
That's funny. It's interesting because, you know, we could even touch on that a little bit. I mean, your life changes a bit when you move from one kind of circle to another circle, from a little pond to a big pond. Yeah. Your life changes. And you have friends that their life hasn't changed. You guys hook back up, but your life hasn't changed, and you're living a different life. So it's interesting to see the contrast. To you, there's this stark difference, like, oh my God. And to you, it's like, what? It all happened step by step. There's nothing's changed.
Here's the thing. Let me touch on that for a second. Sion Chafin was the love of my life, right? And she's married to David Fincher. David Fincher is the biggest director in Hollywood, right? And Sion, every birthday calls me, right? And every birthday I call her. And it's like, she's never gotten so big where she doesn't remember, you know, friendships, relationships, and I love that, and I think that that's a hugely powerful person that can do that. You know, it's like people that do, you know, she's so far above me. It's like you can't even talk about it. It's like David Fincher's done The Game, Fight Club, Social Network. She does everything with him, right? They're married, right? Yeah. And she still calls me, and I think that that says everything about her. And I think that, you know, relationships are everything. So no matter where you get to in life, you know, if you're a particularly strong person, you'll value the relationships that you've had since childhood, like George, my best friend from 7 years old, sitting right
here in the room.
You know, yet those things are priceless.
Well, you know, I can attest to that in my own professional career as well, that a lot of the best gigs I got were because a musician was involved and then drugged me along because they liked working with
me. Right. They liked you and they brought you along.
Yeah. That's, in fact, I was working with a drummer, John Paris. He was playing drums for me on a project. I brought him in from LA to play on a project. And when he was here, he got a call from Earth, Wind & Fire to play with them. And he's like, okay, well, I'm done here. We did Basic Tracks. I'm just hanging out. And he goes, great, we want you here in 3 days because the tour starts and we need a new drummer. Same kind of thing, you know?
Right, right.
So I don't know this is happening. He's just taking a phone call. He's hanging out. Next thing I know, he's sitting at the CD player with his headphones on and drumsticks playing on his lap. And I'm like, you know, what are you doing over there? We're making a record. Right. I'm just interested, you know? And he says, well, he tells me the story. I got this call. I got this gig. And I'm like, oh my God, when do you guys start rehearsals? He goes, oh, we don't. I'm just going to start playing on that date. And I'm like, how can you do that? And he's like, well, I know all the songs. I grew up with them. I just need to know their show and where the breaks are, where the hits are. So he had a CD of a show from a week earlier. And basically, he's still with the band. But what was interesting is after that tour, they did some recording. And I can't remember the record, but it would have been around 2004 or 5. And John tried, they wanted him to play drums on one cut. They still needed drums on one cut. And he tried to get me to come in as his engineer to track the drums on Earth, Wind & Fire record. And they were like, kid, we got a guy. You're the new kid. Calm down. Just play drums. So I didn't get that gig. But the point is, he felt so comfortable with me tracking him that he tried to do that. And I've had a lot of players brought me onto records as a producer or engineer just because the experience they'd had.
Yeah, so you have a certain vibe working with somebody and you want them around. Yeah, absolutely.
Because when you deal with musicians, a lot of times musicians don't know the tech side. Keyboard players almost have to learn it, but a guitar player, a drummer, or a horn player a lot of times didn't have to get into tech that much.
Right.
And so if they were told, hey, we want you to cut a track and it needs to be this sample rate, this bit rate, they freak out. But as long as they know they have somebody who's going to make sure all that goes okay, number one, all of a sudden they feel comfortable, and that comfort level is a big part of what they need.
Sure, sure.
To perform.
And these days with the technical part of it, it's like I have a guy named Steve Stokes in Nashville, and he's a young guy, brilliant at video stuff and brilliant at Pro Tools and everything like that. And rather than me trying to learn all the nuances of what the younger people know, you bring them in, and they can fix everything, right? And they can also do great creative work. But it's like you have to make sure that you don't try to wear every single hat, and you have to make sure that you get it all done. You need Pro Tools to be stable. You can't use cracked plugs. You have to, you know, everything has to be right to have a strong and stable environment. Yeah. So you need people that specialize in stuff like that.
So primarily right now, I know these days, I believe you're a pilot.
Yeah, yeah, I'm an airline pilot.
And so professionally, you're working as a pilot.
Yeah, and I'm an instructor, and I'm a standards instructor.
Okay, and now what are you doing in music? Just sideline, still playing around?
I'm doing stuff for Fervor Records. I'm doing stuff for people in Nashville. I'm doing stuff for movie stuff in Europe. I'm doing stuff for a bunch of different.
So aren't you glad these big airplanes kind of fly by themselves? So you can have your laptop in the cockpit and work on string.
We can't do the laptop in the cockpit. The Airbuses have the side sticks, and I fly the Embraer 195 and 175. So we have yokes, right?
Okay.
So you can't have a laptop on the Airbus. You can. But we're not allowed to do that anyway. So, you know, we can't.
Being a little facetious, but it's neat that you paint that picture.
I mean, I'm flying about 1 month out of six, and I'm teaching the rest of the time. That all the instructors would rather instruct than teach, because we get the override and it's a better schedule and stuff like that. So, like, I'm flying for December, and then the next 4 months after that, I'll be teaching. So it's a great gig. I love it.
Cool.
And so I train initial. I do upgrades. I do recurrent. I train other instructors, and I'm in a $26 million simulator, which is like amazing. It's a thing on stilts.
Mm-hmm.
It moves around on six axes.
That's cool.
And it's really, really cool. So, and that's part of the technical vibe that I've always enjoyed with music. I love math.
The latest toy was always a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah, I love buttons and knobs and stuff like that. Yeah.
So let's go back to Justin's. So technical a little bit. You guys played to along with a drum track or tracks of some sort?
We played along to a CR-8000, I think. It was a basic Roland drum machine. It was before the 808 and the 606 and all that. Really a piece of shit drum machine. But the thing is that it had steady time. And back then, when things were first starting to get off the ground with the techno stuff, we had this machine that we could put claps and snare on 2 and 4 or whatever, and kick on 1 and 3. And then Steve Galladay, who's our dear friend, would play along with it. It was a great, solid rhythm track.
And that's all you had coming through the PA that wasn't live? Was just those claps?
Well, plus then my keyboards, I had sequencers on the OBXA. So I was able to sequence stuff on the OBXA and lock it to the CR-8000, which Steve would then play to. So we had a very primitive techno thing happening.
Plays the role of what these tracked bands do today. Instead of tracks, it was live gear, but you get one play and the clock would drive the other pieces of gear.
Well, here's how it worked with Michael's thing. You know, Jonathan Moffat gets a click through his headphones and we lock into Jonathan Moffat.
Right.
Jonathan Moffat's locked into the box, which is accompaniment, right? Any large artist, Madonna, anyone will have accompaniment. Even Stevie did.
Sure.
You know, orchestras, electronic percussion, stuff like that. So how do you lock to it? Well, through Jonathan Moffat's headphones, he gets this 1, 2, 3, 4. Then he clicks 2, 3, 4 with his drumsticks. The band comes in on beat 9, right? And so that's how we locked on Earth Song, where there's no drums at the front of it. It's just me and Michael. I get the click through headphones. So it'll be 1, 2, 3, 4. And then I play the first chord.
Sure.
Yeah. And so I'm locked to the click and Michael can sing to that.
Yeah.
So... yeah, and it's all the same vibe. You know, you have to lock to a central clock.
Sure.
Back where the Jetsons were locking to the drum machine, the CR-8000. And the drum machine, that CR-8000, had 24 pulse per quarter, which is the same as MIDI clock. which J.L. Cooper managed to get my OBXA to lock to with the LFOs, so we could sequence the sequencer and also the
low
sample
frequency oscillator.
Can I got to tell you a story about Steve Gallaudet real quick, because he's such a good friend of ours. And
yeah.
I lived with him in 8 band houses or something. We lived together so many times. Right during the Jetsons days, I put together a band called Wall Street. I don't know if you remember it, because we only did 2 gigs. I spent almost a year writing songs with Steve.
Okay.
And anyway, it was supposed to be energetic and all that stuff. Well, 2 weeks before the gig, Steve is riding a four-wheeler and breaks his collarbone.
I remember something,
right? Yeah. And then I'm, okay, do we postpone this thing? We got gigs. People are looking forward to our... What we decided to do, Steve said, well, I'll just get a drum machine and program it, and we'll use that.
I remember that.
So
yeah, that's
Steve,
so funny. Yeah.
Steve is standing out front, a cigarette in one hand, a drum machine on a stand, and he's pressing buttons with one hand, smoking a cigarette with the other hand. And we sounded like shit.
That's a new wave band right there.
We completely lost the live energy, you know, with that machine.
Well, you can't. Yeah,
it's not the same.
A drum's a physical feel, so there's no way to play a drum machine with your fingers.
Right. Yeah. No, he had a program, right? So he would just go here, and it would do this beat, and then this beat, and the cigarette in the other end, and this, you know, fucking
great
shit, man.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I remember that. Yeah, that's funny.
Well, we've got about another 15 minutes, and we haven't played a Jetsons tune.
Let's play one.
Should we do that? Because now, you know, we can talk to a guy that was in the band, and the only cut I have is Hard Times.
Okay.
So tell me about that track.
I wrote the hook to Hard Times. Bruce has credit on it. It was just a mishap with the copyright. Bruce acknowledges that. And Bruce wrote the song with me. And when I did the music for Sonic the Hedgehog 3, I took the lick that I wrote, which is the chorus lick, and put it in there. And
cool.
There's been a million internet hits on that, but that's in Sonic the Hedgehog 3, and it's one of the cues. And that was Franco's favorite song, Hard Times. It wasn't mine. Hard Times is okay to me, yeah.
Which was yours?
Probably stuff that Bruce wrote, like I Love You.
Yeah, I love it,
man. Stuff that I didn't even write, yeah.
Definitely. All right, well, the one tune I actually have queued up is Hard Times from the Jetsons. What year then was this probably came out? 82 or 3 maybe?
Hard Times was after Jetsons proper.
Oh, okay.
So maybe 85,
okay.
Something like that.
Cool. Yeah. Let's check this out here on the Auto D Show, The Jetsons, where my guest is Brad Buxer and, of course, Glenn Crimson joining us. We'll be right back.
Take your things and leave. Hard times have the best days of my life. Hard times gone by.
listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
Great track, Brad. That's a pretty cool tune.
Oh, so good.
Bring back some memories.
Good, man.
Bring back a lot of memories.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, a lot of times when we play a song, everybody takes their headphones off and we chat, but I noticed that your headphones were staying on there. It's like he hasn't heard this in a while.
It sounds pretty good.
It's a run back.
And the thing that's so interesting is that I saw Bruce on a video. It's one thing when you're playing with somebody, and of course they're great and all that, but I saw Bruce on a video in another band with Damon after the Jetsons and was astonished at how well he played and how natural it was, and it blew me away. And so I'm thinking, the guitarists I've worked with in Stevie, Ben Bridges and Stevie's band, and Jennifer Batten and David Williams and Michael's band, Bruce could have done any of that stuff.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Speaking of
brilliant player, Bruce.
Speaking of Michael's band, you mentioned earlier that you spent a lot of time at the ranch with Michael Jackson.
I spent more time with Michael over a 20-year period than anyone on the planet. And that's not me saying that. That's on the internet. That's everyone in the industry knows that.
And you also mentioned the History Tour. You guys had started to prepare for that record.
I did 7 album projects. So I did Dangerous, History, Blood on the Dance Floor, Invincible, The Ultimate Collection, The Box Set. And then I wrote Hollywood Tonight with Michael the first album that he released after he died.
So now you're talking about arguably the biggest artist on the planet alive, and you're working with him hand in hand.
Yeah. So day in and day out.
What was that like?
I would tour with him from every live show we ever did up until the time he died. I was with him, right? This Is It never got off the ground. And so
were you in the film then?
I had left. we had a situation where I was working with him through 2008, and he begged me to quit the airlines. And he said, I don't want to work with anybody but you. And he was $470 million in debt. And there was no talk of a tour. He didn't want a tour. And I had just been hired with the airlines. And, you know, I was too old to, like, quit. You can't get hired again after you quit. Yeah. Not at 49 years old, right? So I went with my instincts. And things were, after the trial, things were dark. He was different. So I made the move I needed to do, right?
Right.
And so, but when we were touring, we toured for 20 years, and I did those 7 album projects when I wasn't on tour with them, so I was with them constantly. And he's three months difference in age than me, and, you know, besides George, he's the best friend I've ever had. You know, we had a magical friendship, and we had a musical relationship. Mm-hmm. So best experience of my life.
So you had opportunity too to hang out with Quincy Jones on some of those projects.
No, Quincy wasn't around.
Not at all.
Quincy was around through Bad. Dangerous was the first album that Michael wanted to produce himself, so Quincy was not around.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did he teach you how to moonwalk?
I was with Bruce Sweetine, right, who mixed Thriller, the biggest engineer of all time, died a couple years ago. The core people in the studio, it was always the same. It was me, it was Bruce Sweetine, like for Dangerous, Billy Petrell, Matt Forger, Brad Sundberg, people like that. And Steve Picaro would be there. Mm-hmm. He's a dear friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And a hugely talented musician. So, it was incredible relationship. Wonderful, wonderful experience.
You gonna take the time to maybe write a little memoir at some point?
Yeah, I mean, there's people that seriously. Marcos Cobata is a brilliant film producer, and he's the guy I would do the book with. Mm-hmm. Yeah, people, of course, have talked to me about that.
Yeah,
but he's the only guy I would do it with.
Well, I think for me too, it'd be an interesting movie from the standpoint of a kid from the desert, in a sense, you know, that gets swept up in this all the top notch names. You're not the artist who becomes a star, but you're in all of those circles, and then
The thing is, you end up in relationships, musical relationships with people that you can never repeat. Like Breaking Bad, Bryan Cranston. It'll never be that synergy ever again for Bryan Cranston, right?
Right.
And so for me, you know, I was incredibly tight with Stevie and all that. But with Michael, he didn't really have any close friends his own age, right? And he's not going to keep you around unless you can do a whole bunch of stuff. So I can do a whole bunch of stuff. I can write and be his arranger, and I can play the parts and take what's in his head. And then we also have this incredible friendship. So, and there's stuff that I'll talk about later on, maybe in a book or when I feel more comfortable with it, but that's very interesting. That people would really enjoy. But yeah, just an incredible time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Incredible man. Incredible, gracious, sweet man. Not always perfect, and definitely shrewd. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely shrewd.
Yeah, he's not that innocent.
You know. That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Brad, I want to thank you for coming on the show. Really appreciate you taking the
awesome
time
being
over
here.
This
thank
little
you,
Hollywood break.
Yeah.
And you're going back to Nashville?
Tomorrow morning.
Great. So have safe travels. Glenn, thanks for coming in and bringing Brad
this is
in.
So fun, man.
Yeah, it's awesome, Glenn.
Yeah. So I'm going to look for the book, maybe not by this holiday season, but maybe next. You know.
There you go.
I want to know when the movie's getting done at like a B-roll part. I can be like an engineer in a corner of the room or something.
I got to go smoke a clove now.
There you go. All right, guys. Thanks so much for
coming
on.
Thanks, Otto.
And you've been listening to The Otto D Show, so we will check you out next week. Take care. Have a great holiday.